promoting scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. Greetings from Technocracy News. Patrick Wood here, editor-in-chief, and we're going to talk about automobiles one more time today, and in particular, Agenda 21. Agenda 21, which was created as a United Nations initiative back in 1992, we know it today as Technocracy as well, by the way, including sustainable development, Green New Deal, green economy, natural capitalism, etc. But back in the day, 1992, one of the major points that was seen in the original booklet was to get people out of their cars. Cars were bad. Cars were not only private property, but they emitted exhaust fumes, and they polluted the atmosphere, and they caused global warming and stuff like that. So cars were pretty much declared evil, and the push was on all around the world to get people out of their cars one way or another, and onto bicycles and onto their feet and other modes of transportation, trains, buses, etc. Anything but a car. Well, in the last couple of years, there's been a major initiative around the world to do just that, to get people out of their cars. And how it's being done is that major cities are declaring portions of their downtown areas to be car-free zones. Car-free zones, that's right. We talked about that recently in San Francisco and how Market Street has been converted to a car-free zone. And if you want to get around in that area, you'll have to walk, rent a scooter, perhaps a bicycle, or you might take the trolley. The title of this story today is Cities Adopt Car-Free Zones to Push Drivers Out of Their Cars. I wrote at the top of this, thanks to Green New Deal ideology, cities around the world are banning cars to force drivers to give them up. And listen to some of the cities that are behind this push. San Francisco, of course, New York, Oslo, Madrid, Chengdu, Hamburg, Copenhagen, Brussels, Mexico City. Los Angeles is discussing it themselves even now. The article starts out in her 1961 book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. Urbanist writer Jane Jacobs posed a prescient concern. She forecasted one of two possible outcomes for the urban future: erosion of cities by automobiles or attrition of automobiles by cities. To put it simply, Jacobs declared that if cars and their highways and streets they run on were left unchecked, the nature of the city would be gradually stripped away. She predicted that sprawl would make streets unwalkable, detaching neighborhoods and public spaces from one another. It sounded all doom and gloom unless cities could impede that growth by limiting cars and reducing their influence on the streets. The problem isn't cars themselves, she argued, but the cumulative effect of an urban planning system that prioritizes cars over other modes of transportation. The point of cities is multiplicity of choice, Jacobs wrote. It is impossible to take advantage of multiplicity of choice without being able to get around easily. Cities across the U.S. and the world are experimenting with the, quote, attrition of automobiles by closing certain streets and areas to cars. San Francisco recently approved a $600 million plan to remove private vehicles from its busy Market Street, which will be renovated into space for streetcars, buses, cyclists, and pedestrians. Taxis will share the curbside lane with buses and commercial delivery vehicles, but Uber and Lyft cars are not allowed on the street. In October, New York City turned a one-mile stretch of 14th Street into a busway, banning all cars except some trucks and emergency vehicles. European cities like Barcelona, Madrid, and Oslo have established car-free zones in downtown centers, and these initiatives can prompt backlash, but are often strongly supported by residents. Citizens enjoy having a variety of options to fulfill their transportation needs, and cities are realizing that. In the past, before vehicles like electric scooters or city bikes were widely available, people were limited to cars, buses, or the subway. With more diverse transit options, cities are forced to plan for the improved safety and access, to build streets that accommodate all types of transportation. And that means scaling back on what they've built themselves around for decades, the car. The idea of a car-reduced city isn't entirely new. Cities have looked to close the streets to vehicular traffic and create pedestrian corridors for decades. But what is new is the surge in micro-mobility options afforded to people, which have pushed cities to reassess how to organize their streets. The impending threat of climate change has also added pressure on local officials to cut back on carbon emissions. And now you know one of the main reasons for getting people out of their cars is climate change. We knew that would come up, didn't we? Well, with the advent of scooters and e-bikes and other rentable devices that you can probably break your neck on if you're not careful, cities have decided to throw the cars out and force people onto these other modes of transportation, including their feet. And as the propaganda states that everybody loves a downtown area where there's no cars, they never make mention of the people that do get angry, that are upset because their routine and their life has been upset and turned over. Well, the next story today concerns the internet. The internet is often at the root of a story on Technocracy News and Trends, not because it is itself evil, but it does contain some pretty evil things that go out. Well, the creator of the internet, the original creator of the internet, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, is warning that the internet is being subverted to evil. I think he got it a long time ago, actually. I've been following Berners-Lee for several years, and he has been sounding the warning that the World Wide Web is headed for big trouble. I wrote at the top of this article, in a vacuum, the internet is neutral, but just add humans, and things begin to spin out of control. Evil humans do evil things, and the internet has greatly expanded their capacity to spread evil and debauch humanity. And in many cases, that is exactly what the World Wide Web, we know as the internet, has done. The article states, World Wide Web founder Sir Tim Berners-Lee has warned that the internet's power for good is being subverted by those spreading hatred and threatening democracy as the technology marked its 50th birthday. Sir Tim urged governments, campaign groups, and individuals to back a new plan from his foundation to make the internet safe, fair, and accessible to all. The computer scientist spoke out on the 50th anniversary of the University of California, Los Angeles, Professor Lee Kleinrich, sending the first message on the ARPANET network of computers, which would eventually become the internet. 20 years later, Sir Tim created the World Wide Web, first proposed as an information management system, while he was working for the European Organization for Nuclear Research, that is CERN, which led to the mainstream establishment of the technology. It's astonishing to think the internet is already a half century old, but his birthday is not altogether a happy one, he said. The internet and the World Wide Web it enabled have changed our lives for the better and have the power to transform millions more in the future. But increasingly, we're seeing that power for good being subverted, whether by scammers, people spreading hatred, or vested interests threatening democracy. He confirmed that the Web Foundation, the group he founded to campaign for the open web as a public good and basic right, would publish its contract for the web next month, a collection of pledges aimed at all areas of societies and their commitment to protecting the web in the future. I haven't seen that document yet. I'm anxious to see it. I'm not totally convinced that Sir Tim is completely on the side of liberty and freedom, but he does get one point. The internet is not in the shape that he originally intended it. Our last story has a very serious ring to it. You undoubtedly have been aware from global news that there has been a number of riots around the world, very serious riots where tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have taken to the street, many of them young people, and where looting takes place, cars get burned, buses get burned and destroyed, and generally they cause a melee. There's a number of reasons why people are doing these things, and it's not all uniform on the surface. You would think perhaps it's all leftist, but in some cases, the people that are protesting are coming more from the right than the left. But in every case, you have angry young people who are taking it out on the very property that they are served by in their own communities, which is kind of crazy in a way. But they get to a point where they just don't care, so they'll destroy anything to get people's attention. I wrote at the top of this article, leftists are revolting in the streets around the world to protest any existing status quo, but as they unwittingly merge with technocracy that they could conceivably hate just as much as the status quo today, they are unwittingly fomenting the rise of techno-populism. I have a category, actually, on Technocracy News for techno-populism. I noticed this trend about 3 years ago, developing in Europe especially, where the populist movement, which just involved normal citizens for the most part, was moving towards throwing out the incumbent administrations of their countries and bringing in brand new leadership, whether from the left or from the right. That observation held true regardless. So today, what we're seeing is this meme expanded. The article states, from developing nations to rich countries, people are taking to the streets. Protests are leading to bloodshed from South America to Asia. The reason for the protests differ, but there are a number of underlying questions. Why doesn't everyone benefit in equal measure from greatly increased prosperity? Why are our liberties being affected? Why do the political elites enrich themselves? The demonstrations and the deep-seated discontent can be traced back to the crisis of neoliberalism and the populist response to this. The protests can therefore be viewed as one side of the coin, with the other side being the top of corporate America pleading for a focus on the almighty shareholder. In August, the Business Roundtable distanced itself from the adage that the sole reason for the existence of companies is to please their shareholders, arguing that the interest of employees, customers, and society as a whole should also be given a prominent place in business operations. Ours call comes as business elites fear that governments and populations will take matters into their own hands. For example, via far higher taxes on profits, expropriations, and splitting up of companies, etc. In essence, the most important contemporary political economic issue is how to bring together three objectives in the best possible way. Reasonable to high economic growth, a more equitable division of prosperity. It is, of course, possible to endlessly debate what fair is, and the protection of the earth so that future generations will also be able to lead good lives. Populism could offer something good here if it has indeed woken up the elite and encourages reforms before the entire system threatens to be brought down. U.S. history illustrates this. At the end of the 19th century, inequality had spun out of control. The transition from an agricultural society to an industrial one ensured that many farmers in particular ended up bankrupt. A 10-year depression from 1873 onward caused even more misery. The government was fairly powerless and did little. The emerging wave of populism found its expression in the People's Party, also known as the Populist Party, and its party program, the Omaha Platform of 1892. It included the following fragment. We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized. The establishment was greatly concerned. For a long time, it looked as though the Populist Party was on course to seize power, but it fell apart. It did, however, pave the way for reforms to political and economic institutions by Presidents Roosevelt, Taft, and Wilson, which served to make capitalist democracy more rewarding for the masses and to prevent the collapse of the entire system. In this sense, populism is ingrained in democracy, and it is perhaps a necessary correction mechanism. As Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson state, quote, when the state and elites become too powerful, it paves the way to despotism that silences or coerces the others to go along with it, i.e. think China. But when non-elites become too powerful, the result is not liberty, but the disabling of the state. As they disobey and dismantle state institutions, those institutions atrophy, laws become ineffective, liberty gets eroded, and the key functions of government fall by the wayside. Close quote. The pendulum is constantly swinging back and forth between too much power of the elite and rebellion by the masses. It is important to steer a middle course here, with the elite being seated securely enough to facilitate the proper functioning of the institutions of capitalist democracy, but not to the extent where clientelism and corruption prevail. At the same time, society as a whole should benefit sufficiently from prosperity growth and be sure in the knowledge that it can call the elite to account when necessary. Parties have strayed too much from this middle course. On the one hand, there is the camp with a TINA attitude. There is no alternative to liberal democracy. They have sometimes become blind to the shadow sides of liberal democracy, and this has led to a technocracy, the author writes, that has spun out of control, with politicians essentially being managers. And here we have the long and the short of it. Even though we had to wait to the end of the article to hear it from this writer, I'll say it again. They have sometimes become blind to the shadow sides of liberal democracy, and this has led to a technocracy that has spun out of control, with politicians essentially being managers. I will suggest that the biggest threat that we have around the world today is explaining to people who are involved in the populist movement to stay away from technocracy. They need to understand what it is so that they can avoid it. Otherwise, they're begging for pragmatic solutions. Get rid of the global elite, they say, and let's replace them with managers who can simply just get the job done. This will open the door for technocrats like you've never seen before. And I suggest that they're basically lurking in the shadows right now, waiting their turn. The time will come, they know, when capitalism is going to self-destruct. When it does, people will take to the street in increasing numbers. If you think we see a lot today, just wait. The other thing that's very disturbing about this is to watch what the Federal Reserve is doing today with the financial world, especially, of course, in our country. Other central banks are very much in the same position around the world. All of the central banks combined are governed by the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. They are the central bank to central banks. The BIS, as it is known, sets central bank policy for all the banks in the world. And the central banks in each country then, of course, greatly affect the policies that are implemented by the local commercial banks that exist in those countries. And this is the model that's followed in the United States. Over the last several weeks, the Fed has begun to make short-term injections of cash into the monetary system. They say in order to shore up liquidity. Now, liquidity was a big problem back in the 2008 meltdown of the financial system. And the reason that companies like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns all of a sudden disappeared from the map was that overnight lending and liquidity simply dried up. Banks refused to loan overnight money to each other for fear that they wouldn't get paid back in the morning. So it simply froze the system, and all of a sudden everything just began to collapse. That was a big reason why Treasury Secretary Hammer and Hank Paulson came to Congress and demanded a blank check of upwards of $750 million at the time to bail these companies out so that they would not collapse. And they almost did anyway. And then, of course, we know after that, the Fed expanded its balance sheet by purchasing securities of various types in the open market. And somehow the system got miraculously saved, or at least we could say they kicked the can down the road. Well, nothing has changed since 2008, basically. But now the Fed sees another liquidity shortage coming, much like the one that existed in 2008. But instead of just letting it collapse offhand, it is taken to a policy of injecting short-term money to goose or to bump the immediate overnight money available to banks to continue business. The amount of money that the Fed is putting up for this now is well over $100 billion. and it's on a continuous roll. Nobody can precisely determine what is in the mind of the Federal Reserve Board in conducting this policy, but we do know it shows that they're clearly concerned that liquidity is a problem and that they need to do something on an emergency basis so that liquidity simply just does not dry up again. What this means to us in the economic system out here, most people have absolutely no awareness of what the Federal Reserve does, why they do it, or how it affects them. But one of the impacts on the economy right now and the stock market and other investments like bonds and real estate is this. If liquidity were to dry up again, for instance, let's say the Federal Reserve backs away from its liquidity injections and just says, we're out of money. We can't do this anymore. We're just going to have to let it take its course. Well, the fallout from such a move would have immediate economic effects. The stock market would feel the effect first, then real estate, then the economy in general would contract like crazy. Coupled with the movement towards technopopulism around the world, an economic downturn of significant proportions would exacerbate all of those riding people into this stratosphere. They would just be thoroughly bent out of shape as unemployment would rise, as bank accounts would be frozen, as banks would be even closed. You get the idea. If they're riding during a time of relatively great economic prosperity, just think what they would do if we had any significant adversity. It would not be a pretty sight. This is a very big risk to America and to the world. It's not just America. Whatever America does to its economy, of course, is immediately felt all around the world, including Europe and all of Asia, South America, Africa, and so on. Well, this is something to watch for in the future. We will in the pages of Technocracy News and Trends. And I am Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time.